Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands.
On today's show, we talk with Melinda Gates, a world changer in the lives of women and girls. Melinda is the best-selling author of The Moment of Lift, which just came out today in paperback. She appeared on the Today Show this morning, and she's spending her afternoon with us.
So, Sam, I've lived in Seattle for 8 years, and Melinda is a hometown hero. There are so many influential leaders here in the Pacific Northwest, but I think Melinda stands apart because she has this amazing dedication to issues that are important to women and girls, which is something we both care a lot about. But she's also just really accessible and supportive. I'll never forget when I launched The Riveter in 2017. Right after we opened our doors, we won an award from GeekWire, which is Seattle's tech publication, as the best newcomer in the startup world. And the next day, I woke up and Melinda had tweeted a message of support. And just that small act from someone with such a powerful voice was so meaningful in getting my business off the ground.
Wow, I had no idea. I love that. I love when I hear about women supporting women, especially a woman like her supporting an entrepreneur she had not met yet in her hometown. You know, after reading her book cover to cover yesterday, you know I was cramming. Melinda has become my absolute hero. I didn't realize before how many millions of lives she saved and changed. When she and Bill started their foundation, there was a 25-year lag between the time that Americans received a vaccine and the time it made its way to a third world country. Since they began their foundation, the gap has been reduced to just 12 to 18 months. It's hard to even conceive of how many lives they've saved. And her work with gender and girls and family planning, child marriage, is just so inspiring to think about the impact.
Before we talk with Melinda, we wanted to let you know that we have a short interview at the end of today's episode with an amazing founder, Alicia Chong Rodriguez, the CEO of Bloomer Tech, who's working with a program we love, UBS's Project Entrepreneur.
And now on to our conversation with Melinda Gates. We are so excited to talk to you today.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things I loved about your book is that you describe building a partnership with a man who has a very strong voice. How did you do it?
Well, I think, you know, when our children were born, our first daughter, I started to see all the work that it really takes to raise a child. And especially, I talk about in the book, as she became school-aged, and we agreed on the school that we wanted our daughter Jen to go to, but it was quite far from our home. And by then, we had a second child, and we were hoping for a third one. And as I could see all the years ahead on the freeway driving the minivan to school, I said to Bill, let's just delay and maybe send our children a few years down the line. And he felt strongly that she start at preschool. And so finally, after some back and forth, he said, well, what would make it more palatable to you? And I said, well, if you drove. And so he would drive her 2 mornings a week to school. And it became this wonderful tradition where he started driving the kids more. And it took him a lot of time because he had to make it all the way back to Microsoft. But inadvertently, that conversation in our home meant that in the classroom, we didn't even realize we were role modeling more dads taking their kids to school. And moms started going home and saying to their husbands, hey, if Bill Gates can drive and he's the CEO of Microsoft, so can you.
How did that translate to what was going on at home, whether doing the dishes or scheduling doctor's appointments?
Well, I mean, I think I have to recognize, obviously, that I'm in an incredibly privileged position. And so there are things that I can have, you know, more childcare help probably than many women can, or more help, for instance, with grocery shopping. So I wouldn't say we made a perfect partnership in terms of making it equal. But when it came to the tasks that we were both doing without any support, we would have to have ongoing conversations about who does the dishes after dinner. Luckily, Bill grew up in a home where he and his sister did the dishes, like my sister and I did. But, you know, when it came to who's doing the final cleanup of the toys at night once the kids have gone to bed and left some things around, I had to make sure I said, look, nobody leaves the kitchen until mom leaves the kitchen. And that meant kids or Bill. And so it meant you didn't get to just go upstairs and go to your computer or do your homework. We actually all started doing the tasks that needed to be done after dinner together as a family and as a fivesome. And that really helped us.
How did you meet Bill?
So I was new to Microsoft. I just graduated with a computer science degree and MBA from Duke. I was the incoming MBA class at Microsoft, nine men and me. And shortly after I'd come to the company, I guess I'd caught Bill's eye, and we were both in the parking lot on a Saturday. Everybody seemed to work on a Saturday at Microsoft. And he approached me and asked me out for 2 weeks, I think, from Friday night. And I said to him, 2 weeks from Friday night, that's not spontaneous enough for me. I don't know what I'm doing 2 weeks from now. Of course, he had all these things on his schedule. And so he asked for my phone number. I gave it to him. And then he called me later that night at my apartment and said, okay, well, I have a user group meeting tonight and a customer meeting, but would you be available later for a drink? And I thought, well, okay, at least he's putting in the effort. That's a little more spontaneous. So I met him later that night for a drink.
What was your courtship like? Did you talk about down the road having kids, how you would juggle things, how you would, you know, form a partnership before you got married?
Well, later when we were more serious in the relationship and starting to think about, you know, would we spend a life together, we absolutely discussed number of children. Did we both want to have children? It was imperative to me that whoever was going to be my partner in life wanted to have children and would be committed to it. Luckily, we both came from families that believed in family life. But I think, yes, those are incredibly important conversations to have before you have a life partner. And in addition, during the time we were engaged, we started to talk about forming a foundation because we didn't know exactly when we were going to do it, but we had already committed by then that the vast majority of resources from Microsoft would go back to society in a charitable way.
In your book, you talk a lot about cracking the patterns of history. And you also share that after having this huge career with 1,800 people reporting to you, you're pregnant with your first child, and you say to Bill, I want to stay home. And he was stunned. Is that a decision you hope your own daughters will make one day?
Well, I hope that my own daughters make whatever is the right choice for them. I just knew for me at the time, growing up, I had benefited tremendously from having a mom who stayed home with us as children. She also started with my father, who was an engineer, and he was working at a job full time every day. But she also started a real estate company with him, and we had a real estate business that we were all working on to support our college funds so that the four of us could go to school. But I knew the benefit of having a mom at home full time, and I wanted that for my children for a time, especially early in life. And yet I knew I would always want to go back to work again because I actually loved working and I loved what I could learn by being around curious people. So I chose to step back then that is an incredibly privileged position to be in. The fact that we didn't need my income, which is not the plight of most women in the United States around the world. But for my daughters, I hope they choose whatever feels right to them and their spouse. Same with my son, if and when they choose to have children and you know, are able to figure out how do you blend career and family life.
So much of your work around the world is focused on helping women reach their potential. Do you feel that you have reached your personal potential?
I hope I have not. I hope until the day I die, I have not reached my full potential. Look, I think in life we have so much to learn. And, you know, as long as we all stay curious. But yes, I feel like my life's advocation from everything I've been lucky enough to do, traveling the world on behalf of the foundation, I have benefited tremendously by men and women having me into their homes, and women in particular being willing to share with deep candor what their life circumstances are and the great lengths they will go in these low-income countries to keep their children alive. And it's why I wrote this book, Moment of Lift, in 2019. These women had animated my life and called me to my life's work ultimately as I went home and reflected on it. And so I wrote this book to try and reflect their lives as I saw it and what I think the world can do to make sure that all women can take their equal place in society, whether we live in the United States, because we have a long way to go still here in the U.S. to reach equality, or whether women live in a lower middle-income country.
And now for a quick break. You have traveled the world, and when you've done it, you seem to have gained the trust of the women you've talked to in these different communities very quickly. How do you do that?
Well, first of all, I go in with somebody who's a trusted member of the community that they already know, either another woman who is an educator in the community, maybe a woman leader in the community, maybe an NGO, non-governmental organization that's already working there. And so by building on the trust that he or she already has with the community, then I can come in and be introduced by them, and eventually we can get around to my questions. It takes time, though, and as well, I try to leave time for the women themselves to ask questions of me, because it's not fair for me to just go in and ask them about their lives, and I have to speak with candor about my life as well and what's been easy for me or difficult for me. And I think that's the only way you build that bridge of trust and a relationship.
In the book, you give us the sense that you're uncomfortable mm-hmm. with the amount of wealth that you have. How have you reconciled that?
Well, I'm deeply uncomfortable with the amount of wealth I have, and I think the majority of it should go back to society. I mean, Bill was lucky that, you know, he lived in the United States when he formed Microsoft, and any of us that worked there were lucky for the educations we have that allowed us to work and do that work at the company. So what I try to do when I come home from these trips, or right now during a pandemic where I can't travel to so many places that I do like to go, like Tanzania or Kenya or Malawi, when I turn on the shower in the morning and clean, warm water comes out for me to take a shower, I try to remember, wow, I was in that couple's home, Anna and Sonari. A warm shower would have been a luxury. You know, every third or fourth day, we got to have a bucket of cold water and rinse ourselves off. And I remember, you know, when I do the dishes with my daughter or son or Bill standing next to me, that we have clean water to wash our dishes and to drink that comes out of the faucet. And I think when you can remember those things and be grateful for them, then you're not as separate from your wealth or your privilege as people who are in different circumstances.
And what about with raising kids? I know in my own house, I see that my kids are so uncomfortable with anything that screams privilege. I think this generation is so much more aware of privilege than we were at this age, and it makes them uncomfortable. I assume you've experienced this in your own family. How have you parented given that backdrop?
Well, my kids and I have talked often about being a home where we want anybody to be able to come and to feel comfortable. So if that's a classmate or a classmate's mom and dad and they live in a different part of town, sometimes we've had people come to our front door and you can tell they're incredibly uncomfortable. Their first time, especially a parent at our home, we will sit down on the floor by the front door with the dog. And if you want to have something that gets people to feel equal, if everybody's sitting on the floor with their shoes off and you're kind of petting the dog, they start to see, oh, these people might live a normal life inside this large home. You know, or if you're willing to invite them in the kitchen while you're still in your bathrobe in the morning and you're scrambling eggs and you need somebody to help you set the table and you just kind of go about it, people start to realize, oh, this is a place where they're trying to have a family life too. And so I think you can do things to try and normalize and make it feel more equal to people. And I think we have to go to extra lengths to do that in our home if our children and we are gonna have real relationships. And also to make sure that the relationship isn't always in our home, that it's also out and about in the community. So it's not always on our turf, it's other places that we're doing things together with people that are normal things like going to the park or when the kids were younger, going and meeting somebody at the public library.
You talk a lot in your book and generally about the link between women's empowerment and wealth, which I love. I think women need to talk about money more. How important is it for women to have their own money?
Extraordinarily. And what I have learned from women in very low income settings is that when they can save even a dollar a day, $2 a day into their own bank account on their phone, not a smartphone, an old plastic phone, when they have that means, they will tell you it changes their life because it changes how their mother-in-law sees them if they live in India. It changes how their oldest son sees them when she might be able to buy him a bike. It changes how their husband sees them when they can help bring some money to the kids' school fees for the tuition that's due. So money is power, but women have to have it in under their own control. Women will even tell me, I could finally leave this abusive relationship with my husband when I knew I had the means to take care of myself and my children. So money is vitally important for a woman.
Speaking of power, you really came into your own in terms of using your voice over the years. How did you gain the confidence to realize I have this very strong voice and I want to use it?
Well, I think I had my full voice when I was in high school, in an all-girls high school run mostly by women. I knew what I was capable of doing. I had my full voice. I knew I was good at math and computer science. I lost some of that when I went to college, just with more men around who were more abrasive. I grew up in Texas in a Catholic community. I hadn't really been around many East Coast people, let's say that. And then I think also in the computer industry, you know, Microsoft was a very, it was an amazing place to work, a lot of curiosity. We were changing the world, but there was a lot of brashness there. And, you know, fighting for your ideas. And so I think over time, and then also when I stepped out of the workforce for a few years to raise children, I started to lose my voice and lose my confidence. And then when I came back and started working at the foundation, it was a whole new field for me. And so, you know, I don't have a background in biology. I have a background in computer science. And so I had to have enough courage to overcome the imposter syndrome, to put enough people in around me that I felt comfortable asking questions of and not being afraid to ask questions. And when I finally realized that I knew enough, I didn't know everything. I'll never know everything. You can't know everything in biology. It's constantly changing, or in the immune system, what we know. But I knew enough to do my job. That's when I started to speak out with more courage and conviction, because I knew what I knew, particularly having talked to so many women in these settings around the world. And what they would tell me anecdotally, I would come back and look through the literature and look through the data. Or if there wasn't data there, I would start to talk to enough scientists to find out, hey, what they're saying is true. We just don't collect the data. But it took a journey for me to find my full voice.
It can be hard to choose what things to speak up about. What was the last thing that you had to speak up about that you were conflicted by?
Well, sometimes when you're making calls to members on the Hill, whether it's a senator or somebody in the House of Representatives, you know, quite often that's a male, because there are quite more of them than there are females. Luckily, that's beginning to change. We're still, though, 60 years away from having equality on Capitol Hill between men and women. But so often, besides global health, which they know Bill or I are calling about, I want to also talk about childcare, because I want them to know, particularly during this pandemic, that it's the childcare responsibilities that they're seeing in their homes right now, or they're seeing their daughters do in their homes. They know it. They see it. They can't turn their backs from it. But I want them to know they need to do something about it. We need paid sick days during this pandemic. We need a paid family medical leave policy. Those conversations aren't always easy to weave in, because they'll have other things they want to talk about. But I have to have courage and conviction to use my voice and to take the time to do it. And then you start to find the openings and you start to find a coalition. But I'll tell you, those conversations don't always come naturally or easily when you're starting them up. And I've had a fair bit of that, to be frank, during this pandemic.
And now for a quick break.
I appreciate that you call it an injustice, talking about the childcare situation in America. I mean, the numbers that we've seen of women leaving the workforce over the past few months are stunning. And women have been so disempowered by the pandemic. How do we emerge from this in a way that supports women meaningfully?
I think we emerge from this by giving women their true place at the table, and people of color. We put women in places where decisions, all decisions are made, and people of color with their full voice and their full decision-making ability and potential. And that means investing in women. That means investing in women in the tech sector. I think, Amy, you have a sense of how difficult it is for a woman to start a business and get venture capital funding behind it. And yet tech is pervasive in society. I think we need to make sure there are more women in finance and seats at the table in those powerful financial institutions. Money moves through our society and changes things, but women don't have enough seats at the table. in political office. We need far more women in state houses, in governor's roles, and in the Senate at the federal level and in the House of Representatives, because when you have women and people of color, they make different policies for society because they see society in its full richness. They don't just see it from one point of view. But we need to open up networks for women. We need to put funding behind women. We need to create pathways for women into these key industries if we're really going to have women with power and influence in our society.
What is something that CEOs and leaders can do to make sure in their companies that they're not losing female talent or people of color?
So a CEO, he or she can look at the policies inside their own company and they can get their own house in order. So they can start with transparency. They can look at how many women and people of color are at all levels of the organization. And then they can hold the organization accountable for those people and those roles. So if those jobs have been shed because women, for instance, choose to step back from the labor force because of, let's say, childcare or elder care responsibilities, they can start to say, my gosh, you know, at this level of talent, we've lost so many women or people of color. What are we going to do about that? What do we need to do to change our paid family medical leave policy? What do we need to do to make it more robust? What do we need to do to have more flexibility for moms or dads of people of color? Those are all things that a CEO can do in an instant. But they need to hold everybody accountable for it, not just the HR department.
You have, throughout your career, taken on some controversial issues. You know, you were raised Catholic and you took on contraception, which is incredibly important to women's economic empowerment around the world. What are some tips you would give to other women who are taking on controversial issues, whether it's in their community or in their workplace?
I would say surround yourself with people who can remind you every single day why you do what you do and that you can do it. You know, I have days where I've come into work, or let's say I've gone into a meeting with a world leader, and I'm incredibly nervous or timid or not sure I have all my facts straight. But to have somebody by my side that can remind me, you know enough, and you believe in this. Remember, this is why you're doing it. As soon as I have that person by my side before I enter the meeting, then I have enough courage to say what needs to be said. And I also seem to then relax into myself and remember to connect with this person on a human-to-human level. You'd be amazed at how many presidents or prime ministers want to be asked first about their family, right? They care too. And they're kind of surprised when you first ask that question, but you'd be amazed how on and on they go. And again, you start to build a level of trust so that then when you get to some of the tougher conversations, hopefully they're willing to listen and hear you.
It sounds like you have a great group of friends and you're also very intentional about making time to see them.
I am so incredibly fortunate to have a deep circle of predominantly these days female friends, certainly male friends, but more couples, male friends. I make an enormous effort, as do they. So my Monday walking group that I talk about in the book, there are four of us. We are still walking during the pandemic, but we're doing it holding our phones and putting our earbuds in, and we each walk in our own neighborhood, but we still do it every Monday morning.
Wow.
During the pandemic, again, a handful of friends I'm in two different spiritual groups. We have found a way eventually to meet outside. These days, it's very cold and rainy in Seattle, so it's under somebody's carport with a few heaters and blankets and lots of ski parkas on, and we're socially distanced. But those friendships are the places where I have real candor and trust, and same with those women for their lives. And so when any of us is going through something difficult, and we all have and do in our lives, we can talk about it and we can share and relieve ourselves or even get some advice from one another. And I have found that incredibly invaluable my entire life. But for sure, in these adult female years of my life, I would say.
So are you an empty nester now?
I still have, we have an 18-year-old daughter who's still at home. So she's a senior in high school, but I will be an empty nester reluctantly next year.
How is that going to change your lifestyle with Bill?
I don't really know yet, to be honest, because if you'd asked me a year ago, I would say, my gosh, we're traveling a lot on behalf of the foundation. But with children at home or daughter at home, we obviously made sure we were home a lot for her activities at home. I would have told you a year ago I'd probably travel more. But now work is changing. And to be frank, I almost hope to travel less. I still want to go out and meet so many of the people in these different countries and understand what life is like for them post-pandemic. But I'm hoping a lot of the conferences we go to, the fundraising efforts that we do, you know, we've been able to do a lot of that by video conference and by phone. I hope we can do more of that and so actually have a bit less travel. But we'll see. We'll see how the world looks when we all start to go back to some normalcy.
All right, let's start the lightning round, Amy.
Okay. Melinda, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading President Obama's book right now.
Who leaves you starstruck?
Oh, goodness. Who leaves me starstruck? Well, probably the character Simon on Bridgerton. I've been watching that, and I'm like, ah!
I'm watching that right now, and I actually realized when I asked you when you were dating Bill and I said about your courtship, and I was like, I'm watching too much Bridgerton. How would your best friend describe you?
I would say warm and authentic and laugh easily. I have a deep, hearty laugh, but I think that's probably how they describe me.
What was the last thing you and Bill argued about?
Oh, gosh. Probably time. Who is going to spend time on what? That seems to be our commodity that we don't have enough of.
You sound like every other couple.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially now.
So my big takeaway, Sam, and one I think all of us can learn from, is just how intentional Melinda is with her work and her time. She asks questions, she looks to data just to figure out both what the problems are and how, if she can, she can help. I also found it really interesting that when she's looking to understand a problem or get to know a community, she doesn't just kind of walk in. She finds a guide, so someone who's trusted in the community, who knows the people she wants to know. And I think that I could definitely do that better in my own work. What about you?
So my major in college was social anthropology, and all of our classes were centered around the theme of how you enter a culture respectfully without bringing in your own biases, which is the hardest thing to do as an ethnographer. And Melinda has lived that. It's so rare to meet a leader that exudes as much empathy as she does. My favorite part of our conversation was when she described her family ethos of aiming to make everyone feel comfortable in their home and how they do it. I just love how she infuses her work and her personal life with empathy as a guiding force. She speaks my language.
Sam, I think the one other thing to add to that is, you know, given how amazing the work Melinda does is, I think she would be an amazing asset to all of us if she ran for office.
I don't know. I mean, I always want every woman to run for office. You know that. But in her case, I can't imagine her having an even bigger impact on the world than she's having in her current work. So I actually feel like she's making the biggest difference she can make right now where she is.
Today, we have extra content. With us is Alicia Chong Rodriguez, co-founder and CEO of Bloomer Tech. Her company benefited greatly from Project Entrepreneur, a program created by UBS. Alicia, welcome to What's Your Story?
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So what's your founder story?
Well, just a little background. I was born and raised in Costa Rica. I did my undergrad in Mexico and came to the U.S. to study at MIT. It was there that I joined the MIT Computational Cardiovascular Research Group and met my co-founder, Asil Halabi. Asil and I were shocked to realize about the stark reality that women's heart research lags far behind that of our male counterparts. There are 20 years of scientific evidence that shows that women's physiology is different than men's, yet algorithms and new technologies are still being built around male data. We're at the infancy of truly understanding female cardiac health. Women suffer adverse outcomes that are actually preventable, to the most common causes of death and disability of people worldwide, heart disease and stroke. That's why we created Bloomer Tech, to build personalized diagnostics and therapeutics by using our advanced textile sensors to turn garments, like an everyday bra, into the most comfortable medical device to tailor cardiovascular care to each individual woman's physiology.
Why the word bloomer?
Yes, yeah, so we called Bloomer Tech after Amelia Bloomer, who was a dress reform advocate of the 1800s. She made bloomers replace corsets because they were binding and damaged women's organs. In this technological era, we continue her movement that she started because we believe that our clothes have the power to optimize our health.
Well, I think I can speak for all women when I say thank you to Amelia Bloomer for releasing us from a future of corsets. Alicia, when was your moment of lift, when your idea became a reality?
Yes, you know that when I think about it, I think there has been a handful of moments, but a strong one was actually being part of Project Entrepreneur. We started Project Entrepreneur just days after graduating from MIT, just 3 days after. So it was very fast a decision and great opportunity to join this program. And at the time, before that, I was living at dorms and on a stipend from my fellowship. So transitioning from academia to full-time entrepreneurship was daunting. We had never fundraised and our network was limited. And Project Entrepreneur helped us make this transition. It helped us grow our network and gain exposure to other successful female founders, just like this podcast, which is also great exposure for us. So in that program, we got direct advice from icons like Arianna Huffington and Jen Hyman. And it was not only during the program, you know, afterwards, we've had advice from them too. And we also built very strong friendships with other female founders that are at the same stage as us and participated in workshops to strengthen our business, our pitch deck, our plans. It marked the beginning of our full-time journey, gave us the confidence, and removed many barriers that we might create on our own.
Project Entrepreneur sounds incredible. So where can we follow you on your journey and what's next for you?
Yes, well, we look forward to more women that want to support the advancement of women's health joining us this year. We're at the intersection between apparel, healthcare, and technology, and we have multiple efforts to promote inclusivity in healthcare. So you could join as an individual or as a company, and you can send us an email at heart@bloomertech.com and follow us on social media like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn.
Thank you to UBS for sponsoring today's episode. Their program, Project Entrepreneur, accelerates the growth of female-founded companies by increasing their investment readiness and connecting them to the resources and networks that they need to build and grow their businesses. Since its launch in 2015, Project Entrepreneur has supported more than 1,800 female founders, and I'm proud to say that The Riveter and me are among them. You can learn more about how to get involved in this incredible project by checking them out on Instagram at @PJTEntrepreneur. Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Laurel Moglen, our podcast associate, Emma Hard, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.